This is the Medicast, September 10th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 83. I'm Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to take a moment and welcome all of you to this podcast. If you're a brand new listener, check out the show and some back episodes and head on over to the Medicast website at medicast.com for all of the other content that gets posted over there in the course of the week. Also, you can find links to the Medicast, the Midweek Medicast News Podcast, and a lot of other resources all there at the Medicast website. Of course, for all of you long-term listeners, I'd like to again thank you for all of your comments, all of your suggestions, corrections, everything you do that help make the Medicast community what it is. This is a great way for all of us to share information, and I really, really look forward to getting some of that information from all of you. It's kind of hard to come up with new ideas of things that need to be covered. I try to look at things that are of interest to me, of course, because I learn by researching material for this podcast. But I also want to make sure that I'm helping out those of you that are listening, especially those of you that are in classes. So if you've got a topic area that's coming up that you are feeling a little sketchy on or worried about for your testing, come on over and send me an email and check in with me and let me know. Maybe I can cover it in a topic, or check out the website and do a search there on the left-hand side. You can search the site. You may find that I've recently covered that particular topic area as well. So always do that. And I'll have the contact information at the end of the episode for how to get in touch with me so that you can send me that email or voicemail comment. I got a lot of things done this week to prepare for the end of the month of September. Coming up at the end of the month, I have a whole lot going on in my life that's going to really keep me busy, maybe too busy to get a show together. So I've been putting some resources together to help put out a good product for you, even on those weekends when I'm going to be away and traveling. So I was able to get together with Rick Rosati this week of the Mitigation Journal podcast, a great resource for anybody on the front lines of disaster preparedness, as well as for EMS students, because he does a great job for his local paramedic class by doing in-service training in addition to his regular podcast. So thank you, Rick, for that. And he and I talked a little bit about his concept of the rule of outcomes. And if you're curious about that, you can check out Rick's website. Go over to mitigationjournal.com, check out the Mitigation Journal podcast in the iTunes podcast section, or you can also hang on here and check out the Medicast at the end of, towards the end of the month. I'll be including a discussion with Rick as a tip and trick of the week about the rule of outcomes and how we can apply everyday ideas for one patient to dealing with many patients. I also had a great opportunity to interview Dr. Mike from the Pediacast podcast. Dr. Mike is a pediatrician who runs a great podcast dealing with all sorts of pediatric issues. And while it's directed primarily at parents, I will tell you that there is a ton of great information. I've linked to his show in the past as a link of the week. And Dr. Mike was gracious enough to get together with me by telephone interview, and we talked about the onset and incidence of sports injuries in children. And it's a great interview and a lot of good resources discussed there, including some treatment ideas and just general information regarding sports injuries in children. So that'll be coming up at the end of the month as well while I'm traveling. All of that, I will have a regular Medicast news segment and links and everything else. It's just I've pre-recorded some segments that'll go in as the tip of the week those weeks so that I don't have to scramble quite so much when I get home late on a Sunday night. Anyway, enough about what I've been doing this week. Let's talk a little bit about what you all have been doing this week. Let's jump on into listener mail. I will lead off with a great email I got from listener Rob, who is getting ready to teach his first EMTB course as an instructor, and he just let me know that he's really appreciating all of the information that I get to send out here in the Medicast. And Rob, I really appreciate your kind comments, and for everybody out there that sends in comments like this, it is greatly appreciated. And if you're a student or an instructor and you want to link your friends up with the show, I will do whatever I can to help you do that. I can give you a link for a school website, a button. I'm getting ready to put some buttons together that you can download and create a link for your webpage or whatever you'd like to do. I'd certainly like to be of service and help you guys get the word out and train good EMS providers that are going to be the providers of the future. So I think that's great. And Rob, thank you very much for your kind words and comments. And good luck. I know you're going to be a great instructor. Heck, you're listening to the Medicast, right? I also got an email from listener Tim, who is just checking in, wanted to know what happened to John Bignell's EMS Live podcast. Hasn't been around for a couple of months, and he was just wondering what's been going on. Is John okay? And I have been in contact with John and wanted to let all of you know that he's doing just fine. John is trying to put some new things together and a new resource for EMS providers, and I can't really go into a whole lot more detail than that, but he did promise me that when things were ready to launch, he was going to let the Medicast listeners in on what was going on as on a ground floor opportunity to get in on what he's putting together over there. Based on John's excellent content in the past, I know that this is something I'm going to be really waiting for. So John, if you're listening out there, I can't wait. Get things moving over there or up there or wherever you are. And also, make sure you stay safe, and he has a new baby in the family over the last 6 months, so those of us who are parents know how busy he has been. Tim also was extending me some good luck wishes for my coming semester in nursing school. I've got two more semesters left, and boy, I can't wait. Get this one done, next one done, and then I'm finished. But I just want to say that to everybody else that's in school out there. You know, good luck with your studies, stay focused, keep your priorities straight, and look for the big picture. Look for the light at the end of that tunnel. Thanks a lot, Tim, for your great comments. Long-term friend of the show, listener Heath, sent me some stories in and links about certain agencies for EMS carrying things like pepper spray and extendable batons like police officers use, as well as maglite-style flashlights or other objects that might be used in self-defense. And of course, this links back to my stories in a previous week talking about EMS providers increasingly encountering violence in the field, especially because there seems to be fewer and fewer calls where police agencies are routinely dispatched along with us. So, Heath, thanks for your comments. You know, I agree with you that arming EMS providers with any kind of weapon, I think, is just an oxymoron. I think we need to observe scene safety, protect ourselves, first of all, and we're all trained in this across the board, so there should be no problem with us perceiving a danger and refusing to go in. Now, I know that your supervisors or whatever are going to scream and yell. The public is going to say, but you're heroes, you're supposed to be risking your lives. Well, they don't understand. And we are trained like this across the board. Scene safety is just the basic way we operate. And the sooner the public and the managers and the powers that be that fund our agencies understand this, the sooner we'll be given the resources to back us up, i.e. better police response to calls on dual dispatch situations. Anyway, Heath, thanks for your kind comments as always, and also for the information you send me all the time. It helps me point out stories that I'm going to cover in the upcoming shows, and I certainly appreciate all the time you spend sending me that information. I got an email from listener Kathy from the Monterey, California area, and she had some comments about why she likes to listen to the show. She's been an EMS since 1989 and a medic since 92, so she's been around for some time, but she enjoys the show because she says that EMS is, quote, a constant learning process, and it seems as soon as you think you've seen everything, life proves you wrong. End quote. Catherine, I couldn't agree more. And I certainly appreciate your comments about this. You know, I think no matter what your level of expertise, we can all bring something to the table here. We can all bring our resources to the table, our learning to the table, and our open minds to the table, because you're right. Just because you've been around forever or for a long time in this business does not mean you've seen it all. And your brand new paramedic just out of school could run into something that no one else has trained for or thought about before. And it's our ability to think on our feet, to adapt and improvise, to treat patients and handle situations that is what makes us, I think, some of the best medical providers out there. You know, so much so that I think doctors and nurses just really don't have an appreciation for how we do what we do. And they don't understand that we don't always have perfect lighting. We don't always have beds that go up or down to provide the best angle for us to perform procedures. We have to operate in whatever conditions we find ourselves in order to treat the patients the best we can. And you're right, Catherine, it's just not something that we can ever say we've seen everything. So thank you again for that comment. I appreciate it. Okay, time to move on into this week's news and get out of the intro to the show. And I will start off with a great article I found over at medicinenet.com. And this article talks about the use of non-traditional means of extending health information to the public. You know, I'm a big crusader on getting out there and teaching people and engaging in prevention-based activities. And one of those things is getting out and talking to community groups, getting in front of people where you have a captive audience and teaching them about different things. Well, this article talks about the ways that some organizations are reaching out to different ethnic groups, specifically in this article, Black African American men who are congregating around their neighborhood barbershops as a means of getting a community together and talking with each other and sharing information. And some medical researchers realized this was a great opportunity to share information with people about things like prostate cancer and getting people screened for prostate cancer. And this was, you know, we always talk about how minority groups are sometimes left behind in the mainstream outreach programs. And here is one instance where this group is being included in a special way to get information out to them. And so this is a great article, talks about that, and it focuses on ways we can think outside the box to go out there and educate our public. Where else do we have captive audiences like this? That's what you need to be thinking about. Maybe you take an opportunity to talk about street safety or bicycle safety or bus stop safety by going to your local school and having some kind of a fun school assembly set up with your local elementary, middle, or high schools. Maybe you go to your local Little League football team and ask to have about 15 minutes to talk to the team about making sure they stretch and use their equipment properly prior to the game. All of this prevents injuries on the field. All these types of things can be done, and you have a situation where you have a captive audience. You have the kids, you have the coaches, you have their parents. Whatever the situation is, you have a way to reach out to this particular group that you're addressing and get them some preventative medicine information. Talk to your local health department. Talk to your local hospitals. They all have budgets for this kind of thing, and I think they would all appreciate you helping out in getting their materials out to the public in a new and novel way. The next item I found talks about infant mortality rates in low birth weight rates in Alabama, and looking at the infants in relation to the presence or lack of health insurance in the families they're born into. And, you know, this probably is a no-brainer for most of us. We see the effects of people without health insurance all the time. We see how they delay treatment for routine medical problems that could have been taken care of in a $60 or $70 doctor's appointment. and they delay treatment until they're in severe condition and end up being treated at a local hospital or urgent care center. And so it's no surprise when you find out that infant mortality was 3 times higher in infants when their mothers paid for deliveries out of pocket rather than having private health insurance. In addition, infants in deliveries covered by Medicaid were more likely to have low birth weights and 60% more likely to die than infants that had private insurance. You know, there's a whole list of statistics here, and it just talks about that people that have less opportunities to either carry insurance or their families have made bad decisions about carrying insurance. And I don't want to get into the whole political discussion because, you know, people fall on both sides of that issue. But no matter what happens, these children are falling through the cracks. Now, we either provide them appropriate care and access to free prenatal care for their mothers and free births or something. I don't know. Something needs to be done because these children are dying and it's not their decision to have or not have health insurance. And it may or may not be their parents' decision. I don't want to get into that, but it's something that needs to be taken care of. There is no excuse for us to be in the double digits on where we stand on the list of industrialized countries and infant mortality rates. There are other countries out there that have much lower infant mortality rates in the industrialized world, and there's just no reason for us to be anywhere but near the top of that list. And it shocks me and upsets me when I see stories like this. And it is important for us to be aware of some resources out there. Talk to your local health departments. Talk to your supervisors. See if they can have somebody come in for your next training session that can talk about some of the resources that are available to single, young mothers or anybody that needs the care. But, you know, just targeting a specific group even that you can provide access for them to get good prenatal care so that they don't have low birth weight babies, that they have access to the information they need to have a healthy, long-living child. And enough said about that. Well, some good news is on the horizon for those of us that use LifePak 12 defibrillators and have been waiting for a biphasic upgrade or waiting for our equipment AED protocols to be upgraded. Physio-Control, according to the information I have, will begin shipping again and have lifted their voluntary work stoppage for their products following an FDA QA review. Now, based on my understanding, this QA review was based solely on paperwork issues and had nothing to do with specific mechanical devices or failures of mechanical devices. And in fact, there have been no changes to the production of their equipment. This was merely an oversight or an audit-based issue on how they were keeping their paperwork in line. And Physio-Control apparently voluntarily ceased to ship while they got this information together. And once they had it in place and believed they had everything together, they went ahead and voluntarily resumed shipping again. So for everybody out there that's been waiting for an upgrade to their monitor, I think this is good news. And this includes AEDs and other equipment that may be upgraded to follow the new AHA protocol and the new AED upgrades that are necessary to follow that protocol. And I know that I'm glad to hear this news as well. I put a link to the Physio-Control site and some of the information you can find over there about the different equipment that is being produced. Finally, I will wrap up with a story on the World Trade Center workers. And just a follow-up, I mean, there's been a lot of medical studies based on the data of the health registry of the 28,000 workers that were around and operating in some role at the World Trade Center disaster site, whether they were involved in cleanup or actual recovery. All of them have numerous medical health issues. And this latest story talks about some of the psychological problems that have been evidencing themselves. And this is just another indication that we need to really find some way to provide a resource for these individuals. The survey found, the study found that 1 in 8 of the recovery and rescue workers helping in the cleanup had evidence of post-traumatic stress disorder, and that especially evident was this in workers with little or no prior experience with specific types of disasters. In other words, some of the volunteer workers, construction workers, and others that came in to help out were more likely to have PTSD symptoms than some of the professional rescuers at the scene, although the professional rescuers had higher rates of PTSD as well. The study found that 12.4% of the workers were likely to have PTSD, an anxiety disorder caused by traumatic events. Now, if you look at the fact that the health registry is a survey of 28,000 workers, that is about 3,500 people that have PTSD. When you compare the 12.4% number to the public at large, the public at large has about a 4% PTSD rate. And so clearly these people are at greater risk to suffer the trauma in their lives psychologically following this disaster, even years later. And it's incumbent on us to provide some resource for them to get out there and get some of the treatment that they need, the counseling, the assistance that they may need so that they can continue to be productive. These people don't want to be on the dole. These are people that came forward and offered their assistance either as volunteers or in a paid capacity to get in there and help deal with one of the greatest tragedies in the last 100 years to befall this nation. And it's really abysmal that we haven't done more to track in on these people. Hopefully, the follow-up to this particular study is going to be some kind of increased ability for these people to go out and get resources to find the help that they need. I certainly hope so. In any case, that's going to wrap up this week's news. It is the week that we, 9/11 is coming up this Tuesday, and it's a week that we all have this particular tragedy in the forefront of our minds. Here we are, 6 years later. What are we thinking about, and what are we doing to deal with these kind of things even this many years later? So check out the story. It's over at emsresponder.com, and I do have a link to it in the show notes. Okay, so I've talked about PTSD, but what is PTSD? And that means it's a great opportunity for us to cover something new in the tip and trick of the week. Post-traumatic stress disorder is an issue that all of us should be very aware of, because we are in a profession that is more likely to encounter post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of the type of work that we do. So we should need to be aware of it in ourselves and our coworkers. We also need to be aware of it because we may encounter veterans coming back from the current, previous Gulf War, or other violent events. And we need to be aware of what we're looking at and understand what PTSD is. Now, later this week, I'll have a post up with some checklist items that you can use and keep handy, so that if you run into something that you're worried about how you've been acting lately, you can kind of go down the checklist and see if maybe you have some PTSD issues related to a previous call that's bothering you. It's important to seek treatment, and treatment is available for this particular illness and can be treated very successfully. PTSD is a real illness. You know, I talk about this all the time. When somebody has a broken arm and they have a cast, it's easy to say, oh, you have a broken arm. But people with psychological issues have very real physiological problems, and they are just as ill as if they had a stomach virus or a broken arm. And that illness, it can be and should be successfully treated with compassion and understanding. So PTSD is something that happens to people after living through a disturbing or frightening experience, and it can be successfully treated. People who have PTSD can get PTSD following a rape or sexual abuse, when they are hit or harmed by someone in their family or someone else, victims of violent crime, people who are victims of car accidents or airplane crashes, victims of natural disasters, of course, people who have been involved with any kind of military action or war, and any event where you thought you might be killed or were in danger for your life. In fact, even bystanders of such violent events can experience symptoms of PTSD because of witnessing the tragic events or violent event. If you have PTSD, you may often have nightmares, scary thoughts about experiences that you went through, and you may actually try to stay away from anything that reminds you of your experience. Have you anybody out there had a coworker suddenly quit the business after a bad call? You know, we see it all the time. Well, maybe we need to provide better resources for these individuals, and we may not lose good providers when bad calls happen, because you know what? Bad calls happen. I mean, it's just a fact. We're going to run into something that's going to bother us at some point in our careers. Whether you're brand new or been around for a long time, there is some issue out there that's going to get you on an emotional level. When you have post-traumatic stress disorder, you may begin to feel angry. You may be unable to trust or care about other people. You may actually be so on the lookout for danger everywhere that you begin to act a little paranoid. You begin to become very upset when something happens suddenly without warning. You act out aggressively and protectively when surprised, either surprised in a real sense or surprised emotionally. Something didn't go the way you planned, and that change in plan because of a surprise event can cause you to relive your traumatic event emotionally. Now, people who get PTSD usually have signs and symptoms within about 3 months of the event, but in other people, in a significant amount of other people, signs may not show up until years later. And when it happens, it can happen to you at any age. So even children can experience PTSD and have symptoms show up later in life related to something that happened to them as a child. And people in the United States have PTSD at the rate of about 5.2 million Americans. Now, I talked about the World Trade Center workers. They add about 3,500 people to that list, right? Okay, they have a higher instance. But in general, about 4 to 5% of the American public that you may encounter may have some signs or symptoms of PTSD. Most importantly, persons with PTSD need to get out there and talk to their doctor. You can talk to your family practitioner. You can ask to speak to a counselor in your workplace. You can go to check in with your local health department about mental health resources. There are counseling services out there that can help you find resources in your area or talk to you by phone to help get you on the path to recovery. Talking to your doctor will let them know that you're having scary memories, that you're feeling sad or depressed. Maybe you're having trouble sleeping or feel angry all the time. When you have these problems, and let your physician or your providers know that you can't get things done, that it's affecting the way you deal with everyday life in your workplace and at home, then you can find and seek appropriate treatment. What can the doctors do for somebody with PTSD? I mean, I said that counseling's available. I've said that treatment's available. And what specifically is out there? Well, PTSD is an anxiety disorder. And so it can be treated by some of the medications that are used to treat anxiety disorder. It can also be used, can be treated by patients who have some more depressive symptoms by giving them antidepressant medications. People that are on PTSD symptoms may get medicine to treat their symptoms. They may also be referred to specific counseling or therapy. And therapy helps people work through what's bothering them about the specific incident. In some cases, people may not even be aware of what specifically is causing their PTSD experience. And so by identifying it through some therapy sessions, someone can actually say, you know what, that's what's been bothering me. And the therapist can give them resources and methods to deal with thinking about those particular topics. In one person's story, and I found this over at the National Institute of Mental Health site from the NIH site, which, of course, anyone's listened to the show knows it's one of my favorite resources for tips and medication information. There's a story over there where someone says they were attacked and they felt afraid and depressed and angry all the time. They couldn't sleep, they couldn't eat much, and even when they tried to stop thinking about it, they had awful nightmares and recurrent memories. And they were confused. They didn't know where to go for help. And then someone said, you need to go talk to your doctor. And their family physician helped them find the resource of a therapist that helped them deal specifically with PTSD. It took some hard work and some medication and therapy, but that person is on the road to recovery. And I think that's the most important thing for us to realize is that this is a treatable illness and it's not the end of a career. It doesn't have to be the end of a family relationship. We need to be aware of this in our own workplace and in the people and patients that we deal with so that when we encounter someone who has experienced problems with PTSD, we'll be better able to understand what's going on in their lives and better able to provide the compassionate and gentle treatment that they need while we transport them to a healthcare facility so that they can get the assistance they need. Enough on this. There's links to all of this in the show notes. Check it out. I have a link both to a Veterans Affairs site on PTSD and the National Institute of Mental Health site that I talked about in the specific tip of the week segment. I'm going to move on into the Med of the Week this week. And this week's Med of the Week, I'm going to kind of jump back into a series of segments I was doing before on patient medications that we run into in the field. And to help us understand when we get that list of meds, what we're looking at and what these particular medications may do and how they may affect the patient, how maybe an overdose or side effects of a medication may be manifesting in signs and symptoms that we're either personally assessing or having reported to us by the patient or the family caregivers. So this week I thought I'd talk about a drug called Fosamax or Fosamax. And that's the brand name of the medication. The generic name of the medication is alendronate, and alendronate is a medication used to treat and prevent osteoporosis in elderly men and women. Now, women and men, as we age, lose bone density. Usually we think of osteoporosis or brittle bones syndrome as a female disease, but osteoporosis is actually occurring in men as well. And it's based on the loss of calcification of our bones as we age. We get older and we stop eating as much in our diet. Our GI tracts become less effective at absorbing nutrients, and we begin to use up stores of calcium that has been put down in our bones as early as adolescence. In other words, we take in a lot of the calcium that we're going to carry with us through life, the calcium stores through life early in age. And then when we become older, we lose that calcium deposits, which are used to supply the ionic calcium we need to have adequate heart contractility, to do all the things that we need to do with that particular mineral in our daily nutritional needs. And because we're unable to absorb it as effectively, we need to use that calcium from our bone stores. And so because men tend to have thicker and denser bone mass, we don't often think of osteoporosis as a male problem simply because we carry around more bone calcium in our daily lives and are less likely to run out of it in the end of life. But it does happen, especially in people with thinner bone structures. And of course, in women who have thinner and less dense bones, they also become more apt to experience brittle bones when a certain level of calcium loss is achieved. Alendronate is used to treat people who are experiencing osteoporosis and is a medication that will work to prevent the breakdown of bone and to increase bone density. And it does this by interfering with the osteoclasts cells. Osteoclasts are the breakdown cells in our bones. Now, constantly, we store and release calcium in our bones all the time. When we're younger, we have a net increase on that side, but it's a constant process. You know, the body constantly, you know, when we eat something that has a lot of calcium, it stores it, and then throughout the day, it takes some of it back. And so those osteoclasts are there to take that bone mineralized calcium out and put it back into the bloodstream where it's needed to be used. This particular medication interferes with some of those osteoclasts removing the calcium from the bone, the decalcification process. This medication is taken orally, usually on an empty stomach first thing in the morning, to improve its absorption and to reduce the incidence of side effects. And if this drug is not taken directly as ordered by the doctor or pharmacist, it can cause some interesting side effects and some painful side effects that the patient may not directly be aware of. Now, Fosamax or alendronate can damage the esophagus or cause mouth sores when it's not taken properly. So it's important to take it appropriately and drink a full glass of water with the medication. So why do we need to be aware of this in the field? We're never going to give this drug. Well, you know, you want to be aware of what patients are doing. You know, you come with somebody that's maybe coughing up some bright red blood that's signs of an upper GI bleed. Perhaps they've irritated their esophagus because of the way they're taking their Fosamax. So just ask them, you know, you take this medication, when do you take it? Oh, well, I sometimes forget. I take it in the middle of the day and I take it after lunch and I do this and I do that. Ask them, do you take it with a full glass of water? Do you make sure you drink that 8 ounces of water to make sure that you get it all the way down? Well, no, and I don't usually like to do that because I'm never that thirsty and it just doesn't taste right. Well, here you know. Maybe this is the reason they're having a problem. And you can relay that in your report when you get to the hospital, and the nurse and the doctor can re-educate that patient at that time. So it's something to be aware of, that sometimes the way patients take these medications can be causing some of the symptoms we're seeing. We don't want to, you know, blow off a GI bleed. I'm not suggesting that. But again, good history taking, and this is included in that, can sometimes find the source of the problem. So besides GI irritation, what other things are we likely to see as side effects? Well, the total list of side effects for this medication is nausea, vomiting, stomach pain, constipation, gas, bloating or fullness in the stomach, and change in the taste of food, possibly bone, muscle, or joint pain, headache, dizziness, and flu-like symptoms. Now, some of these other symptoms that may come up are more severe and may be an indication of allergic reaction to the medication or an adverse drug interaction with something else the patient is taking. This includes increased or worsening heartburn, difficulty swallowing, pain when swallowing, chest pains, bloody vomit or coffee ground vomit, black tarry or bloody stools, fever, blisters, peeling of the skin, rashes, itching hives, the whole line of things. Also, hoarseness, which would go along with irritation of the upper GI tract, esophagus, and perhaps even extending into the irritation of the posterior oropharynx. All of these things are important to pay attention to and may, in fact, be the reason you're being called to the patient's house to transport them when there's a suspected GI bleed situation. So, again, a good history. Find out what medications they're taking. Make sure you have a complete medication list, because some of these symptoms may be caused by concurrent use of things like steroids or other medications that may need to have their doses adjusted, not necessarily completely removing them, but adjusting their doses appropriately so that they have the necessary effects. When people overdose or take too much of this medication, you may find patients experiencing severe heartburn, nausea, abdominal pain, bloody vomit, coffee ground vomit, difficulty swallowing, or again, black, bloody, or tarry stools, all signs of GI bleeds or GI irritations. And in fact, when a patient has these signs or symptoms, it's important to make sure that we don't lie the patient flat, that we try to keep them sitting upright in order to let gravity help us keep the stomach contents in place until we can get them to a situation where they can be treated appropriately. So this is a quick overview of Fosamax or alendronate, and just a little understanding of this particular medication will help you be more knowledgeable when you run into somebody with some of these symptoms in the field. In fact, this medication may be the source of their GI problem. And you know what? I think that's going to wrap up another episode of the Medicast. I again want to thank everybody for your contributions, comments, and suggestions that everybody sent in this week, as well as all of the kind words and just general encouragement that I get. It really helps me out to know that you all are getting something out of the show, that it's helped you in a class you're taking or helped you on a call. I certainly love to hear about all of that, and I want to thank you again for getting back to me and letting me know about what's going on with you in the field. I also always appreciate anyone who would take the time to leave a review of the show, either over at the iTunes store on the Medicast page. You can head on over there and use your iTunes ID. Just click on leave a review and you can write your own review of the show and leave your honest comments over there. There's been several people that have left just great reviews that I think help point other people to the show, that tell them what they might expect to get out of the podcast. And everybody's experience there is different, so it's always great to have reviews over at the iTunes store or over at EMS Village or any other EMS site. You can go ahead and leave a comment or a review on any site that has access and links back to the Medicast, and I certainly appreciate that. If you want to contact me here at the show, you can do that a couple of different ways. You can reach me by email, by emailing me at podmedic@mac.com. You can also check in with me using the Medicast voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. You can leave a comment over there, a question, and at the very end, always try to remember to leave your email address. I'll trim it off if I play your comment on the show, but it gives me an opportunity to get back in touch with you if I need clarification or want to further investigate what you're talking about. So always do that, and you can check out the voicemail line to leave a personal message while you're driving along and want to get in contact with me while you're listening to the show. If you'd like to get all of the show notes links sent directly to your email address every Monday morning when the new episode of the Medicast comes out, you can do that. Just check out the sign up for the Medicast newsletter at the upper right-hand corner of the site. Click that link, fill in the quick little form there, and you will be signed up for the Medicast newsletter. A copy of all of the links in the show notes will be sent directly to you, so you'll have an idea of what I'm going to be talking about in that episode when you download it. And also, you'll get a separate little bit of extra tip and trick of the week that I include in the newsletter every week. Not something major, but a little maybe memory tool or a little tip for evaluating a patient that you might not already know. And so it's just a little something extra for those of you that sign up for the Medicast newsletter. It's absolutely free, and that is a private email list. I don't share that information with anybody else. In fact, it's all handled by a separate provider to protect you from spam. You actually have to click on a link to accept that you've been added to the newsletter, and you can unsubscribe at any time just by clicking the link at the bottom of each newsletter. It'll take you back to a page where you can just unsubscribe and you're all done. So it's a great way for you to keep in contact with the show. You'll get 4 or 5 emails a month from me just talking about the episodes and maybe once in a while other important information that's going on. I guess I'll finish up as I always do with some PodSafe music. In honor of the anniversary of 9/11, I'm going to finish up with a song that I've used several times in this particular day or this particular week's episode. And that is a great version of Amazing Grace played by the City of Washington Bagpipe Band. And there's links to this particular song in the show notes. There's actually a direct download link as well as a link to the iTunes store if you'd like to purchase the entire album or other music by the City of Washington Pipe Band. So without further ado, I'll finish up with Amazing Grace. And as we're listening to this, I think we all need to just keep in our thoughts and prayers the family, friends, colleagues, coworkers of those that died 6 years ago this week while going to rescue others, doing the job that we try to do every day, and just going about their daily lives, doing what they do best. And I think we need to keep that in mind and be ever mindful of their contributions and sacrifice for all of us. Until next week, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Scene Safety, BSI.